Hello and welcome back to our podcast on the fanfic of the fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game about a post-early wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. I'm joined again with my co-host. Say hi, Weird.
Hello, Sir Weirdington Esquire, is what you should have said. But then you left it to me to say it, and so I did.
Yeah. I'm never going to get it right, so we're just going to have to live with it. So, hey, we're back again.
Well, I don't worry so much over it. I take special joy in correcting you, and so it all works out. It's a symbiotic relationship.
Ah, perfect. So, hey, yeah, we're back again. Episode 4, we're not dead yet. So, you know, thanks for coming back and saying hi and listening to us madly ramble about this insane fic. So, yeah, let's just get started. Weird, what we learned last week?
Okay, last week we had a doubleheader, two chapters of this fanfic of a fanfic. Oh, actually, I think it might have skipped my mind. Let's see. All right, so we were introduced for the first time to Footsburg in the text, Hoofington. Wait, in order to pass to or beyond it? Okay, I'm really letting you down on this one. It was give you a highlight reel of things I remember. At some point, one of the nihilistic tots, the Crusaders, had to pass through a corpse-strewn zone in order to either get the last leg to Footsburg or out of it to somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember why they would have to leave. And Blackjack spies some usable equipment among the like piles of faintly irradiated corpses from the Apocalypse War. And in spite of her pip buck, presumably using as an antenna system the antlers that I now insist must be mounted to it, didn't detect any hostiles. Like it has a magical like detection system, and it detected absolutely nothing animate besides our compatriots, our three heroes. And so she started looting, and it turns out that like all the ghouls, all the cannibal, the nightmare zombie cannibals, we're just napping.
Yep, taking a nap.
And while
had a snooze,
while in their suspended state, were undetectable. This was against the advisement of the stud who is always right, who inexplicably predicted this negative outcome, in spite of his entire life up to this point being that of a gigolo slave. But yes, so for her temerity, the child must die. And so in the style that we've become increasingly familiar with of a early aughts Newgrounds Flash animation, an extra tiny pastel horse is ripped apart by hungering ghouls. There's a brief conversation wherein our Blackjack has to convince a irradiated, glowing zombie version of a character from the original My Little Pony show that she's an old friend, until they're finally able to slip away, whereupon Blackjack is now suffering from extreme radiation poisoning and emotional trauma. P21, the stud who is always right, quite distressingly, gives us an insight into our author's opinions about how to deal with extreme emotional trauma, as he's always demonstrably right, and what he has to say is, oh no, just choke down on those feelings. You don't have the right to be emotionally distressed over what just happened, so don't be. But we do need to treat that radiation sickness, and so thereafter there is a extended fight with mutant crocodiles to get to a hut that probably has medical supplies in it. We get to the medical supplies. Blackjack has a little time to recover before we're eventually led into a abandoned weather satellite relay. Like a
You're doing really good at weather station. Recalling all this off the top of your dome piece, by the way. I barely remember all the things that happened in these two chapters, and you're doing a great job so far.
An extended fight with robots. We're introduced to the best character, a Pegasus, who is given a job from the totalitarian sky fascists that apparently all winged ponies like escaped and isolated themselves into like a single aerial city. Her name escapes me, even though her buzzing drawl does not.
Her name was Morning Glory. That was the name of the character. But yeah, with her insufferable soft buzzing drawl.
Who volunteered as a member of a Peace Corps to like go down and like visit the surface and like get reconnaissance on what is even happening and if there's anyone to reestablish diplomatic ties with left. And it turns out that the entire mission was sabotaged. Like, she was like essentially expected to die because like her gun is basically a flashlight and their armor was made of tinfoil.
Oh god, they're the Imperial Guard. God.
Anyway, yeah. After clearing out the robots, she tentatively joins the Morning Glory, joins the party. I think her name is Buzzing Drawl henceforth. It's the only. Anyway,
it's the only way you can remember her name.
Yeah, that's the best I can remember. So I remember that the last time we talked about the guessing game that we've given to our listeners, what perk was acquired as of our previous episodes, as of our previous missions. I seem to remember that the first one was sort of out of nowhere, that it was rapid reload, and then the second one was weirdly appropriate, unexpectedly appropriate, so like we don't have an established trend to go off on. So what were the perks acquired from these previous
two chapters? The perks for these last two chapters were, so when she became irradiated, if you remember from last week, she developed a mutation.
She was mutilated. She became a hideous mutant with cool eyes, glowing amber eyes. How will she ever muster to bear to be seen in public again with these rad eyes?
But yeah, so as long as she's irradiated, she basically acts like a small flashlight. And then on top of that, to compound that, she just has like, she gains good low light vision, which is a very like D&D made up kind of perk that like it's like okay, whatever. But yeah, that I think that does a great job of summarizing our last two chapters. So we're gonna see how this episode goes. There's not a lot that happens in chapter 5, but there's a lot to talk about it. And then there's a lot of that happens in chapter 6.
Not much happens, but we've budgeted a lot of time for it. Okay.
So this is either going to be two chapters or one chapter being covered. I'm still experimenting on this, and this is kind of unprofessional, but who gives a fuck? It's our podcast. We'll do what we want. So anyways, we're going to launch into chapter 5. Now, chapter 5 opens up
on Stone Age meme of Pinkie Pie, like, with her one-man band set up. Hate.
Oh, man. Cursed.
I think you mean exquisite. That was one of the best and better memes to have come out. The original show?
It's all cursed. All
right.
It's all cursed all the way down. But yeah, we're given a geographical description of Hoovington proper. This is not really important except for the fact that like I don't like since I'm not American, I don't understand the reference to the geography. I'm guessing this is supposed to be New York because of the way it's described. But Hoovington is described as a like city in which a river splits the like core of it in half, like sort of it cuts around it, and then there's outer boroughs around it, which to my understanding is vaguely how New York is like constructed.
New York is like Manhattan is an island, and like they're like divided, they're famous for divided boroughs, but there are twin cities, I think, Seattle, and I am now looking up the twin cities, so keep going and I will eventually like shout the likely reference.
like a madman.
Yes.
Like a mad jukebox. But yeah, it's not really particularly important, but like it was interesting to try and see like what the headspace of what this city's supposed to be described as. And the best I could think of is probably New York City.
Possibly Minneapolis, St. Paul. So speaks
the people. And the only reason why I was confused about that is because in FOE, Manhattan is a city, but it doesn't it's never really described like New York is and Hoofington is. Footsburg is described the way it is. So I don't know. I was just very confused by this. But anyways, we're given a little bit of a description of it, and our little cavalcade of broken ponies finally get to like kind of the city boroughs proper, and they hit their first actual major landmark that is like an actual city for the first time, and not just a bunch of raider camps. A giant Walmart-esque, Costco-esque building with the neon sign name that says Mega Mart, and underneath that says Finders Keepers, which it denotes that it's owned by the Finders Kitchen. Yeah, but yeah, they bump into it. They it confirms yes, this is the Finders headquarters. They get into a little bit of a thing with the guards who want them to pay up because the Finders are all about money, and that's when BJ name drops the stupid radio DJ name that was given to her security mayor to be able to get in free.
Oh, DJ person, right?
Yeah, good old DJ human. We're given a big description of it. It's kind of a meeting grounds of all of the other factions, so we get like a bunch of cutaways describing a bunch of all of the other factions that exist within Footsburg. The whole of the interior of the Walmart has been restructured to be like a small market town for traders to do business in.
Okay, so like to clarify something I didn't understand before. So Footsburg is sort of a New York situation. Like we like long since entered Footsburg State, and we're on our way to Footsburg City.
We are in Footsburg City, and we're technically in the outer boroughs now. And they almost never interact with the actual core of the city because it's considered some sort of death trap. But anyways, the only other important detail about the Mega Mart is that the entirety of the interior of it is protected by a giant roof-mounted turret just called the Gun. It's basically built so that if anyone tries to do anything, they will get fired out by a big-ass gun and become, you know, splattered gore.
All right, so it's mounted to the interior roof, the interior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I said roof, I meant ceiling, I guess.
All right.
They have a giant seal, like it's a post-apocalyptic Walmart with an interior turret ceiling gun.
Reinforcement had to go into. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen the typical like Walmart, Costco like soft tile ceiling. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean that's certainly a friendly environment that encourages a lot of like open trade is the looming panopticon with bullets. God.
They honestly should have just called this damn thing invisible. They should have called this thing the invisible hand for like how much this is just like to give away the game too much, but like the Finders are basically capitalism ponies, so that gets to be a fun thing in a hot second. But anyways, they get let in because the leader of the Mega Mart wanted to see them, a mayor by the name of Bottle Cap. They meet Bottle Cap while they're all being like oohed and awed about the wonders of trade. And Bottle Cap, I always thought it was kind of neat that Bottle Cap wears a Mega Mart manager like vest, which I don't know, just because the idea, like I like the Arat's like weird apocalyptic nature of hey, welcome to Walmart.
Well, I mean, it does speak to, like, actually that is actually a pretty clever thing, especially if you were going to, like, lean on the, like, sort of nightmare Terry Gilliam's Brazil dystopia of, like, okay, so in this, like, it's been a generation since the world ended, and so the cargo cult understanding of who the, like, supreme dictator, the ultimate overlord of a space like this, is this uniform. This is what the masters of this building of old wore, and so it is what I.
Yeah, said. I don't know. It's one of those things. It's like, oh, this is actually a cool little bit of like descriptive prose that illustrates a character and their identity well. She even has a little name tag that says, like, your friendly Mega Mart manager, which I thought was kind of fun. They have a conversation with Bottle Cap. We get vague screeds both by characters talking during this part and BJ's internal monologues that, like, the idea that, like, the trade will save the waste is a big thing that gets introduced with the Finders. Because the idea that, like, the markets are neutral is a, like, myth that's perpetuated a lot by this story and also a lot of other stories.
Wow. Okay. So, man, this would seem to have, like, a really strong beef against, like, the My Little Pony source material, like, then, because, like, all right, so I guess the core moral of this story is that friendship, like, relationships for their own sake, like, human compassion, that failed. The only way out is pure commodification of all interactions. Well, it's pure neoliberalism. the idea that, like, everyone is strictly an individual, like, that there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals. And so, like, the only acceptable way to, like, interact with other individuals is through the commodification of those interactions, that, like, everything has to be an exchange. Mm-hmm. And this is the way out of the nightmare of the total dissolution of society, is to rebuild it along these, like, purely exploitative, like, commercial exchanges.
Well, it definitely pits the concept of, like, the idea of markets and capitalism is antithetical to savagery, since the idea being that, like, you're not going to shoot the person that you buy your guns off of, because that's just bad business.
But wait a minute, if you did that, like, then you just have their guns. Like,
yeah.
And, like, the... Man, these people are always, like, endlessly telling on themselves. Like, they can't, like, keep their... Because part of what's so great about this heroic wonderland is the nightmare panopticon in the middle of it. Is the Eye of Sauron that is mounted with miniguns overseeing all of this. There is a monument to violence literally hanging over everyone's head, like the sword of Damocles.
Yeah, like, to the point where I know that the author didn't intend this, but it works as a really good metaphor for, like, the nature of the market as presented by capitalism.
I mean, if this author was aware of what they were saying, the gun would actually just be called Damocles. They would nickname it Damocles.
Well, okay, so to give away a little bit of it, though, the reason why it's called the gun is because it's referred to by at least a couple of characters when it shoots somebody as the wrath of gun, as in the wrath of God.
Oh my God. Holy shit. Oh my gun. Praise be to gun.
The gun is good. It's actually kind of an amazing bit of accidental, like, implication given. Because I know that, because I know from later stuff that's said in the story, that the author does not think that, like, did not intend for this. They just sort of accidentally did their way into a fantastic little market metaphor.
Libertarian propaganda is so exquisite because they are constantly telling on themselves. It goes all the way back to, like, the source of the term utopia. Like, the original, like, screed, utopia, was, like, I can't remember off the top of my head, like, a 16th century work wherein, like, this dude was trying to describe the perfect society and called it utopia. And in utopia, everyone is equal. Also, every household has 2.5 slaves.
I'm sorry?
Yes. Mandatory. Every household should be provided with slaves captured from outside of utopia, and to discourage gold greed, to discourage the love of gold, within utopia should be legally mandated to always be seen in dim light and worn by slaves. That everyone's household slaves should have gold chains around their necks.
Oh boy!
To associate their condition with gold. So yeah, like outside of this podcast, like there's some hilarious things to be said about Ghostbusters and its like attempted advocacy for libertarianism that like pretty one-to-one demonstrates like its own like crippling faults. So this is amazing. But
yeah, we gotta get back on track, or we're gonna actually be yelling about capitalism for an entire episode, which is half of this episode. So let's get into it. Anyways, they have
praise
a,
be to
a
gun.
Nice, praise be to gun. They have an amicable conversation with Bottle Cap. She basically praises them for killing the Raiders, and there's kind of that like more that misery pissing contest where like you know. BJ's all sorts of busted up. 21 is still recovering from a broken leg, and Gloria's watched absolutely everyone she's ever known for the last couple of weeks be eviscerated in front of her by robots and raiders. But Buttlecap's just kind of like, "Oh, that's all you've had to deal with?" And I'm just like, "All right, we get it. The apocalypse sucks. Like, you don't actually have to keep reminding the audience that like the apocalypse is a bad time by having characters constantly dick measure how much suffering they've gone through." Which I also like, honestly, to like I guess get on the rant train a little for like a couple minutes here. What the fuck does a like capitalist who runs an entire market have to fucking worry about the tragedies of the waste when they have their entire market is protected by guards and a gun?
She had to dispose of a half a dozen potential usurpers today, some of whom she liked. So
God,
there.
It's fucked.
Also, it really speaks to like the sort of like there are two. It's been said that there are two essential moral frameworks, both of like two different responses to trauma. One is, I have had X trauma occur to me. I will do everything in my power to see to it that nobody else suffers that trauma. And two, I have had X trauma to me occur to me, so I don't see why anyone else should be spared of it. This story seems to be firmly in the latter category.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Like, a horrible thing happened to me. Well, too bad. Horrible things happen to everyone. Why should you be spared?
Yeah. It's a real mess. Anyways, they...
Friendship flows from the barrel of a gun and the jingle of a heavy purse.
God. So since they decided that they actually want to deal with the Maltese EXE and figure out what it is, they asked Bottle Cap, okay, so we need to be able to recover this. She says, well, okay, that's going to cost you a lot. Something to the ring of about 10,000 caps, which puts us in my least favorite part, like, arc of this story. Well, it's not my least, but it's one of the least favorite arcs of the story. The pointless, shitty side quest arc, where they have to collect 10,000 caps before the story will progress. So they look over the bounty board, and they tick off a bunch of bounties they think are easy and also not heinous and soul-crushing enough for them to take care of.
I mean, at least they depart from reality, wherein they probably would have just been offered a, like, crushingly usurious loan.
Yeah, now there are no loans in the apocalypse, because, you know, you can't expect someone to be alive next week. But yeah, so they tick off a couple of them. I'm going to read out a couple, like, the ones that they deal with over the next two chapters. They have to, they need to kill a bunch of radioactive scorpions to get their glands to make something that's a reference to Fallout New Vegas, which... How dare you bring this much better story into your fucking crap, Somber? They need to get a bunch of materials from a weapons development building that is covered in robots. And they also need to the term is used is move a bunch of squatters out of a medical facility on behalf of the society. Does anyone know about this episode going to be very short, but it's a lot?
It's known to some as patience. About.
Oh, it's much worse than that. It's not patients, it's doctors that they want removed.
These are framed as
well.
The good
they're
guys.
Morally gray. It's not the Finders. It's another one of the smaller factions that on the Finders bounty board. Basically, the story is a morally ambiguous to treat all the factions as pretty ambivalent. They're just against each other, and that's their big problem, which is. It's its own problem. Like, it's its own baggage that, like, all of the factions are basically, like... Even the pretty, like, obviously evil ones are still given their fair shake. Because, you know, everyone deserves their chance. It's like, these guys have slaves. Everyone has their chance. But yeah, before they leave, and something I guess I forgot to explain because I forgot it was important. Because this keeps happening. Back a chapter ago, when they find
I mean, it would be unthinkable to dismiss someone from the marketplace of ideas just because like we disagree.
That's a degree to disagree that you have slaves. They're called serfs. They're slaves. But yeah, to backfill, because I forgot about this, when Morning Glory was arguing with a centuries old audio tape about the nature of the Enclave, a name gets brought up, which is a character by the name of Rainbow Dash. And for people who don't know the deep My Little Pony lore, Rainbow Dash is one of the main six members of the original cast. She's one of the primary characters. She's a gutsy flying Pegasi pony who's cooler than everybody else in the story. She's rad to the extreme. In this story, it gets explained, Rainbow Dash was one of the Ministry mayors, along with the other six. And when the bombs fell and nuked the whole of the waste, RBD, her first instinct was like, no, we need to go down. We need to save as many people as we can. And the Enclave Council that had been formed at the time, or the Pegasi Council, was like, well, Cloudsdale already got nuked, which is their capital. We're not really in a position to, like, help people who aren't Pegasi. So we've taken under review, and we've decided that we're not going to help anyone except for ourselves. And RBD flew down and went, fuck that. Flew down into the waste and went missing and hasn't been seen since in the story. Now, when BJ asks Glory about this, this is where it gets into some worrying context. Glory doesn't like the fact that Rainbow Dash went down and tried to save people from the waste immediate, because in her mind, the actual concept used is that we should have waited till we were strong enough to be able to do it. And in her opinion, she believes that her doing that made it harder for the Enclave to want to care about doing it. So it took them 200 years. She sort of indirectly blames the fact that Rainbow Dash wanted to help immediately for why it's taken so long for the Volunteer Corps to get formed in the first place.
Oh yeah, no, makes total sense. Like, hey, did you know that the New Deal prolonged the Great Depression? Also, the Confederacy inevitably would have given up their slavery on its own. It's just good sense. It's just the most sensible thing in the world.
See, this is another one of those things where, upon rereading, I've grown to like despise characters because I forgot that Glory was like such a neolib. Like she's such a neolib apologist of like the essentially like, because the Enclave are like in no uncertain terms basically sky Nazis. Like, they're basically sky fascists. Like, they wear black fucking outfits for fuck's sake. Like, black uniforms for fuck's sake. They're super militaristic, xenophobic, and hate any pony that isn't a Pegasi. So, like, they're fucking Nazis in the sky.
Nazis, they're as right-wing as it gets. With diamonds. Nazis it's so... in the sky with wings. So... Oh, talk about your Luftwaffe.
No.
So in spite of having like opinions like these, she like volunteered to like go do a thing. Like,
it gets much dumber than like, that.
Volunteered to repeat like what she regards as like a fundamental moral mistake.
The moral mistake was doing it when they weren't prepared or ready to do so. She wanted to get all the ducks in the row and all of it set up. She wanted all of the structure built before they went and helped other people.
Like that is self-evidently as represented by the equipment they were given, an endlessly retreating goalpost.
Yep. The Volunteer Corps was a doomed ship from the start. Everything that Glory believes in is a lie. But it gets much dumber as we carry on with the episode with the chapter. So we fast forward into them dealing with scorpion ponies. That doesn't even make any sense. No they're just irradiated scorpions that want to kill them. Nothing really important happens here for the most of it. It's just a lot of like more prose of conflict that isn't very exciting.
And then they went all bang bang bang, and then blah blah blah, and the scorpions are like bah!
Yeah,
and
then imagine that every single time I'm reading these gunfights, and it's basically what's happening. The only two important things happen of note with
Sounds like scintillating literature.
It really is. I mean, like, admittedly, if you're into that sort of thing, then like it's gravy. Like if you like prose about people eviscerating each other in like stark detail, then it's the story for you. It was the story for me 5 years ago, but I also like my brain was broken, so like I at least have that excuse. But it just isn't very exciting in the now. When you're reading it for like review for a podcast, it makes all these chapters incredibly short feeling, and it's why I'm constantly stuck with trying to either cover too much or cover too little, because I have to like jam episodes together because none of this fighting is important. Anyways, the only two things that are important that happen in this fight is, first of all, BJ finds some more dead crusaders that have been stabbed by these scorpions, and finds one of the patches. Oh god, I forgot to describe their uniform. So the Crusaders have a little uniform, which is a little cape that has a small, like, filly, like a small child horse rearing up. It, like, has a little patch on their capes, which is a reference to the main show. But she snags the little, like, patch as a way of remembering Scootle. And the only other thing that's important that happens from this Rat Scorpion fight is that Glory gets stabbed by one of the scorpions and fills her up with poisonous venom. Because of that, they have to make they have to rush from that immediately to the research and development lab that they were going to try and steal the stuff so that they can make an antidote really quickly. Whew. Okay, they get her on a couch that's in the building, and they fight more robots, but again, that isn't really important. And all the while that it's happening, she's having like a weird fever dream exposition where she's talking about stuff that she knows and things, and it alludes to the idea that she isn't quite just the Peace Corps pony that they first assumed that she considers herself to be. And then P21 and BJ bicker over saving her, whether it's worth it or not, and BJ ultimately falls into the side of, I don't care, it doesn't matter if I don't trust her, I'm going to save her anyways, I'm not letting somebody else die under my watch. I think this is around the time that P21 does that thing of like, I might be the smart one, but you're the one that trusts in everybody, and it's good to have an optimist and someone who's positive about other people in the waste. Yeah, it's a weird out of character moment is I guess why I'm focusing on it. Oh, this is where it gets real dumb. So while they're looking over the stuff, while they're patching up Glory using their anti-venom that they made, they happen upon one of the main offices of the building, and the little name tag on it is Dr. Trottenheimer. Just take a moment and drink that name in, stew over the fact that they named a character Trottenheimer.
Oh, okay, but Pony Oppenheimer.
Pony Oppenheimer.
Does he have does he have Shiva on his flank?
No, he has a little plaque that says "I have become death" on it, though.
What?
It has the "I have become death. I am destroyer of worlds," which is, I get that is the reference, but like,
wait a minute. So that's okay. Let's clarify. I think we might have skipped a step. So where is this written?
It's like on a little plaque on his desk.
On a plaque on his desk. Okay. Because for a moment that like I was talking about like his cutie mark, like I was expecting like,
oh,
his
cutie
mark is Shiva. That seems ominous. Well, anyway, welcome to R&D.
I don't even remember what his cutie mark is. It might not even say, because we don't see this.
It was a really big mushroom, but it seemed kind of hazy in a weird way, almost as though it were a cloud. No one could make sense
of
it. But
anyways, they search through his stuff, and they find a weird gun that they've never, that BJ can't identify. It's of complete alien construction, and I don't mean literally alien. Don't go thinking about that, because Fallout has aliens in it. Doesn't mean that this is alien. I just mean it looks weird. But it has completely alien. BJ remarks that like its barrel and bolt like would house a bullet that is bigger than like any bullet she's ever seen before. Also doesn't understand what like how it fires, because it doesn't even have a trigger or firing mechanism of any kind.
But it's just roughly
gun-shaped, it's not like the energy guns that are gun-shaped and shoot lasers. It's a gun that still has like a hole, like a bore and hole and stuff, and like has like, in theory it can fire. I'm only really talking about this a lot because like So when she puts it in her bag, it names the gun Trottenheimer's Folly. And it's the reason why I'm pointing out this a lot, but like I'm making a big deal about this, is that this gun is in so much of the story. It's so critical to a huge chunk of the narrative. Like a vast amount of everything that happens that goes wrong in later chapters is because of this fucking gun. It's the most cursed piece of material that she has in her arsenal. So that's why I'm just kind of like warning signs. Here comes the big thing. Anyways, they have like Gloria has a brief moment of lucidity coming out of her fever, her poison fever. And they have a more frank discussion about Fash ponies. The Enclave. It reveals that Glory isn't just a volunteer corps like yuppie. She was some sort of medical and like medical tech and engineer that was working on some sort of project that involved like bioweapons that she wasn't comfortable being on the project anymore because of like the risk that it could hold to all pony kind. And so she asked to transfer to the volunteer corps. So she is like she's an actual doctor. Like she's a doctor and scientist and not just like volunteer horse, which is kind of just really reiterating what like kind of has already been said about her. Like we sort of already knew that she was like a medical doctor, but like,
well, she's like a Hollywood, she's a professor doctor, doctor professor of science.
Yeah, well, she's like a biological engineer, I guess would be like the better term for it. But like, but she also does surgery. Like she's capable of doing surgery. Like she's like,
I mean, she's Bruce Banner.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a Hollywood interpretation of science
to
and doctoring.
Gamma radiation. Like, yeah, her, like, being a medical engineer means that she is literally a structural mechanical engineer, in addition to being a surgeon. My God, she's literally a rocket
surgeon.
Yeah, of
course. That's just how that works, right? She literally is. She fixes a rocket
exquisite.
At one point. So she literally
I'm back
is a
on
rocket
board.
Surgeon.
I'm totally on with this. Like, Sombra is a genius.
Sombra is a genius. Anyways, they crack his terminal, and this is where like a thing that like I've talked about this with people in the past, but like this is something I really wanted to yell about on podcasts. Terminals really suck for storytelling, and I kind of hate that like. The authors are so married to wanting to like exposition through characters reading notes off of something. Like the main problem is it just isn't really engaging in any real way. It's such a crutch to try and explain, okay, but like why is this happening? Oh, here's a convenient terminal that explains all of a person's relevant notes that they took on the thing that's happening. And that works for a video game because it's hard. Like
and
it's,
also, like as somebody playing a video game, you can pace your own engagement.
But it's between this and Memory Orbs that like my brain like shuts down the story a lot of the time because it's so hard to keep in my head. Okay, like oh now there's just this totally irrelevant character that I don't care about having a thing happen in the backstory. But so much of the note taking of this story has been me like, okay, I need to remember this character's name because in 40 chapters they're going to be relevant again, so I guess I better get a move on it. And it becomes exhausting. It's so much work just jotting down stupid things that are said in terminals. But to actually get into talking about the actual like meat of this terminal stuff, Trottenheimer is an incredibly insufferable character. He's a super egoist who hates that he was forced to step down from whatever his scientific position was, and now he makes bullets and he's not happy about it. He's, I put disgraced engineer because I'm not quite sure what his job was. Like, it's pretty obvious that he made the nukes, but, like, other than that, like, he also made a bunch of other stuff, and it overlaps a lot of what technology would actually count as for that sort of innovation. But yeah, he was a disgraced a scientist who, in being forced in that, he was also being overlooked by one of the ministries. I've talked about these ministries a couple of times, but this is the first time this one's becoming relevant. The Ministry of Morale, which in theory, or at least in presentation, the Ministry of Morale is meant to maintain the morale of the state and keep everybody happy. But the Ministry of Morale, over the course of the story, started overstepping its bounds more and more and became the kind of terrifying watchdogs that regulated everything that people did, and to the point where they actually developed, like, interrogation magic and technology to thought screen people so that they could make sure that they weren't even thinking illicit in crime thought.
Let me guess. Overseen by Pinkie Pie?
Yep.
There's a character. You got it. There's a character who's like entire ethos I associate with conformity. Like, I haven't seen, like, I don't remember a lot of My Little Pony episodes, but, like, one of them was precisely about the, like, the one time Pinkie Pie, like, couldn't let someone be miserable. And ultimately it resolved with, like, her not only acknowledging, like, this person's boundaries, but becoming deeply, like, deeply invested in, like, not merely, like, not trying to change this person, but find out why, like, why they were, like, what made them the way they are. And got them, like, got this, like, grumpy old man back in contact with his family. So, like, yeah, no, I made this joke on, like, I guess probably even the previous episode, but, like, the idea that the My Little Pony characters would, could or would ultimately, like, create nightmarish Orwellian bureaucracy, like, kind of falls apart with Pinkie Pie as a character in premise. Like, she would be the candidate to, like, say,
yes.
Hey. Yeah, something's gone real wrong, guys. Rather, hey, guys,
this doesn't seem like such a hot idea. Like, I run a minute, like, I'm a crazed drug addict, and also I run an organization that steals people's memories and screens people for thought crime for being dissenters in the military. That isn't so great. I don't know what happened there.
Man, what a nihilistically ugly view of Pinkie Pie as a character. Like, what a grotesque, like, takeaway from... All right, so that's in the background. And wait a minute. Why is R&D? Why is, like, weapons R&D under the purview of like the Ministry of Love?
No, it is, but the Ministry of Morale can come and go as it pleases. Is a big thing about them. Because if it's on the grounds of potential dissent, they can go anywhere, basically.
You can never expect it. I guess that's the main core. Like, right. Okay. So, yeah, we're just gonna compartmentalize.
Take away
that
from
now.
It on this.
I'm gonna put that in a different part of my processor and just gonna stow that away. we're gonna take P21's advice. Like, he is the stud who's always right. Good on you. Yes, just compartmentalize the things that you can't confront. All right. So what happens next? They have Ponyheim, Trottenheimer's portable doomsday weapon.
So to go a little bit more into the thing, I'm gonna kind of just spoil details now that kind of suck and don't matter and are stupid, and they start getting nodded to early on. The Trottenheimer is only confidant in this terminal, as he mentions, a character by the name of GB. And GB isn't a character that's in either the story, either in the main story, in original My Little Pony. It's a character that's made up for the story named Golden Blood, and he is the most I refuse to use the term Mary Sue, but if I could be torn away from using the term Mary Sue on anyone, it would be Golden Blood. He is this the most insufferable. It was secretly my plan the whole time for fucking everything that has to do with this story. Like, Somber rewrotes the entire narrative of the original story to just kind of be about, like all of the past stuff is kind of this character's fault in insufferable ways that kind of requires incredible bendy logic to explain why everything happened the way he decided it needed to happen. And it's just, like, God, it's like these two characters make up a bulk of the stuff that happens in the past that connects to the story, and they're just so annoying. Like even on my original read of the story, I remember getting consistently frustrated with the presentation. Like, it's okay. So to reel back.
And so the prophecy is fulfilled. The circle is closed. The snake has devoured its own tail. Not a lot of things happen in this chapter, but by golly, do we have a lot to say about it. All right, so did I hear you correctly? Golden Blood? That's a very setting consistent name. All right.
Well, for you see, he's the nephew or younger brother of a character that's in the main story named Blue Blood. He's what if that snotty, hotty-totty character was actually like an evil Machiavellian super pony, and that's basically what Golden Blood is. Like, I'm going to talk, like, the story is going to keep talking about Golden Blood, so, like, I'm always going to have something to say about him that's insufferable, but, like, Golden Blood is an example of Sombra not getting, like, why a conspiracy is potentially interesting in an apocalyptic setting, because it pins basically every single cause directly down onto one particular character, and the conspiracy is no longer fascinating in that regard. Like it's in one way or another, everything is related to him in some way or another, and it's incredibly tiresome.
Hey, no, this market is like perfectly great and sustainable. What with the the panopticon that blows people's heads off in the middle of it. Like there is no society, just individuals, and so like there are no mistakes don't happen. Like grand societal tragedies don't occur. Because of systemic problems, it all boils down to some bad actor somewhere.
Yes. Golden Blood is the example of that bad actor. Like he's a perfect like personification of it. But I'm not going to get too much into detail about it because it's going to just go on forever. Oh, Christ. Oh, chapter sucks. This chapter sucks in different ways than the child murder episode, because this chapter is just really like it's really boring and short. It's filled with a bunch of dumb side quests and just characters expositing at each other to pad time, and then coupled with a bunch of libertarian nonsense and poor understanding of military and poor understanding of like how governments work. But like the one last point I want to make before we go that I wanted to reel back from before we do our ending and we talk about the part like we hint at the next chapter and shit. The thing I really wanted to reel back, and like one of the other details that I find really frustrating by this, is that like by no means is FOE a feminist story in any real capacity, but at the very least, at least all of the characters of importance and relevance are women, because the main story, like, you know, My Little Pony is primarily features women in it. So, you know, it's kind of cool. Like, it's not, I guess, great, but it's still interesting to see, like, a story that's primarily about women and men kind of just picking the sideline for once in a story, especially a fan fiction. And Somber took that and misunderstood it entirely, is what I feel from it, and went, no. Men have to be the cause of everything secretly. It's not only all these women, they know nothing about running a government. It's all Golden Blood figured it out how to make this government run efficiently. He's the one that created all the morale ministries in secret. He's the one that structured everything against everybody. He's the one that's been planning all of the stuff and advancements. He's what led into the nukes getting invented. The nukes got invented by a dude, even though that's the name. The person who invents the nukes is never given in the original story because it's not really necessarily important. Also, the history of the H-bomb would require so much more, like, lore to be in Fallout Equestria. Like, because you'd need, like, for there to be the H-bomb, you'd need to have a pony World War II, because you'd need all the pony World War II scientists to help invent the H-bomb and carry it over to America and help development. Which would have meant having a pony Hitler and pony World War One and a fucking pony France Ferdinand. Like, it would have required so much extra shit just to explain how the nukes got invented. So it's so unnecessary to add to this character in the first place. And then the audacity of making it this like snooty masculine character who's just better than everybody else is disgusting. It's so bad. It's so lazy.
Well, I don't know. I think the sort of extraordinary thing is we already had this character called Blue Blood, who is this oligarch, who is an archetypical oligarch. But we can't have him be this character because he is definitionally, like, provably not worthy of his own arrogance. So we have to devise a new one. We have to, like, Bluebud 2.0, except that his claim to aristocracy is legitimate. He is the Aristos. He is rule by superiority. So much so that he is able to manipulate all of, like, the entire My Little Pony core cast, who are framed as, like, the best and brightest of their generation in all ways. So, like, this is sort of, like, yeah, this is archetypical, like, villain Sue. Like, this is, he's morally wrong, but, like, you know, secretly he's kind of right. Like, Thanos did nothing wrong.
He had to exterminate half the civilization, like, of all of existence. He just had to. And that's a recurring thing with Golden Blood, is that Golden Blood is constantly forgiven and apologized of his, like, atrocities, because, well, it's because the idea is given that, like, this had to happen. Like, there is a part where basically Sombra goes, well, it was actually this bad guy in the background that was manipulating everything all along, so I could just, Golden Blood could just wipe his hands of all the blood he's ever created. Like, he's validated because this war had to happen. It was an inevitability presented by Sombra. Which is also, like, kind of antithetical to, like, Fall Equestria, because Fall Equestria, the whole kind of thing about it is that the war is a comedy of errors. Like, a bunch of just accidental tragedies happened. Like, a bunch of pirates took over a yacht and it killed a bunch of military people, and that caused, like, tension, and then just one accidental misunderstanding of soldiers getting killed by a group, it led to a school getting blown up, and it's just a bunch of stupid shit that happened, and it's, like, kind of a good metaphor for the nature of how wars are often entirely random and how that they're started, and they're not, like, meticulously created directly by assholes who are plotting everything in the background for...
No, Fat, you see, that wouldn't do. If the world were that chaotic, then markets couldn't fix it. The invisible hand will always be there for us, save for the machinations of bad actors. So with that in mind, a cheery tune in our hearts, do you have any closing thoughts?
Fuck Somber, and fuck Golden Blood. But yeah, I guess that's our episode. This one got me a lot more hot-blooded than I thought it was going to be. But yeah, that's our app. Leave us a review on iTunes.
Oh, actually, yes. Again, validate us. We don't have enough stars for iTunes to recognize us as having any stars at all. We need more validation. We need more likes. So please like, subscribe. We rely on you for word of mouth. So please tell anybody that might be even faintly interested about us. Praise be to Gunn.
Praise be to Gunn.
And this was all a terrible mistake. I've got the alcoholic glow.